KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm very excited to have on the show my colleague at Elon, Professor Mike Rich, who's written a couple of really interesting articles that overlap in two worlds that we cover on Hearsay Culture, one extensively and one not as much. The extensively covered area is the issue of technology and its ability to both control and expand the abilities of human beings to do and act in ways that they might or might not want to act. So the technological aspect is something that we cover regularly on the show. The less covered but I think fascinating area that I've wanted to get into in the show, and Mike's work gives us an excellent opportunity to do it, is the intersection of technology and criminal law. We've had some of that discussion more recently because of the unfortunate events surrounding Aaron Swartz and his prosecution or attempted prosecution under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. We've had other discussions of criminal copyright and other IP enforcement issues. But we've not gone into the area that Mike is writing about and one that is a perfect topic for today's show. We're going to be discussing two articles that Mike has authored. The first is an article entitled, Should We Make Crime Impossible? An article that has been published in Harvard's Journal of Law and Public Policy, and one where Mike approaches this question of the abilities of technology to actually not prevent crime, but literally make it impossible for a human being to perform. And so we're going to be discussing both the technology itself and the implications of this technology on today's show, with particular reference to the Driver Alcohol Detection System for Safety, otherwise known, I guess, as DADS, although I'll ask Mike to correct me on that one. But we're going to be talking about the various issues that surround the question of, again, as Mike puts it, should we make crime impossible? As part of that discussion, we're also going to be discussing another article that Mike has written, one that's forthcoming in the Connecticut Law Review, entitled Limits on a Perfect Preventative State, where Mike goes through an analysis not just of this DADS system, but also a topic that is more familiar to Hearsay Culture listeners, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, and talking about the pros and cons of this notion, and I'll ask Mike to define it, of perfect prevention, a term that Mike is introducing into literature, and I think one that is useful as we think about the abilities of technology, but also the drawbacks of acting in this way. So Mike's work, it crosses over a number of lines on Hearsay Culture, ones that I've wanted to get into, and I'm fortunate to have Mike as a colleague at Elon and to have the opportunity to do a quote-unquote live recording in what I euphemistically have called the East Coast studios of KZSU, which means my basement here in Greensboro, North Carolina. Mike is somewhat comfortably cramped into my basement studio, using the mic that I normally use, and so I have, for those of you that are real audio geeks, you may be interested in knowing that I've jerry-rigged the microphone that I use for my guests on top of a stack of mail with some CDs in a way that should probably cause perhaps some minor neck discomfort, but otherwise will sound good via audio. So, by way of very brief introduction before we get into the discussion with Mike, Mike, as I mentioned, is an associate professor at Elon. He joined us at Elon from Capital University Law, I should say, because, of course, this show is on KZSU-FM Stanford, that Mike is an alum of Stanford Law School. To be clear, I did not know Mike when he was at Stanford because his time there getting his JD predated my time as a fellow at CIS. He was a law clerk to Judge Susan Dlott of the United States District Court for the District of Ohio. He also practiced at Hughes Hubbard and Reed in New York, and we didn't overlap there either. At least I didn't run into him. He's published several articles, including the ones that we're discussing today, and I'm very excited to have him on today's show. So, Mike, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with a question, Mike, and you know, look, I know the answer to this question because we work together, but I think the listeners would find it valuable. Tell me more about how you got into this topic and why you got into it.
Well, it really was just by happenstance. I was listening to the radio on the way home one day from work and heard a story about a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration push against, for states to outlaw the use of cell phones while driving. And as kind of as a little side note during that news story on NPR, there was they mentioned that some scientists at Rutgers were working on technology that would in fact block the use of of cell phones by drivers, and thus make it unnecessary to criminalize that activity. And that just got me thinking that that's an interesting and different way to approach crime prevention than we've had in the past. I mean, typically we try to prevent crime by kind of incentivizing people not to commit it, or by just, you know, making it so socially unacceptable to do that we kind of make them choose not to commit crime. But here we would be taking some activity that we would otherwise criminalize and make it literally impossible for people to do.
So when we're talking about this notion of impossibility, and I think, you know, obviously listeners will be generally familiar with what we mean by crime, but I want to define up front a couple of terms that you use so we can start definitionally and then get into the details. So two phrases or terms that you use that are important up front. I mentioned this notion of perfect prevention that you've introduced in your Connecticut article. Give us a definition. What do you mean by perfect prevention of crime?
Well, perfect prevention is in some ways best defined by comparing it to the other ways that we go about preventing crime. So, and this is kind of building off of some definitions given to us by Professor Carol Steiker at Harvard, and she talks about first the punitive state, which is the use of the state of punishment in order to disincentivize committing crime. So, in other words, we punish people to either, you know, teach them that they shouldn't commit crime, or to show others that if you commit crime, you'll be punished and you shouldn't do it. Then there's also the preventive state, which is a much more narrow thing that the state does, which is to try to identify those individuals that are most likely to commit crime and try to isolate them and, essentially usually imprison them before they're able to commit crime. The best example of that is sexually violent predator laws, where, we identify those individuals who have shown a proclivity towards committing sexual crimes, and then we isolate them from society, essentially imprisoning them before they can commit those crimes. But the perfect preventive state differs from both of those in a couple of ways. I mean, first, unlike the punitive state, we don't wait until people commit the crime to act. So, taking the driver alcohol detection system for safety as an example, there we would have technology in the car that would make it so that the car wouldn't start if the driver had a blood alcohol level above the legal limit. And so there you're preventing the criminal activity. We're not waiting for it to happen. On the other hand, to differentiate it from the preventive state, perfect prevention acts against everybody equally. There's none of this screening where we try to identify those individuals most likely to commit the crime. Rather, we're treating everyone precisely the same. Again, taking the DAD system as an example, this would be a system installed in everybody's car, which would differentiate it from, say, ignition interlocks being placed in the cars of people who have proven to be more likely to drive drunk, which is something that every state has some provision for, where once you're convicted of a crime, of drunk driving, in some situations you'll be forced to put an ignition interlock in your car, blow in a tube, and your car won't start if your blood alcohol level is above the legal limit.
So, and there's a lot there which we're going to dive into more deeply. The other phrase that you use, which is related to this notion of perfect prevention, is the notion of impossibility in committing crimes. So there's a lot of ways that one could be put in the position where it would be impossible for that individual to commit a crime. What do you mean by making crime impossible in the context that we're discussing today?
That's a good question, certainly one that I get a lot when I'm discussing these ideas, because whenever you tell people that the state is going to try to make something impossible, particularly when you're talking in the technology realm, the response that you often get is that the state can't make anything impossible. Nothing is ever made impossible. People will always get around whatever the state tries to prevent you from doing, which is true. But what I mean by impossibility is we're talking about the goal of the state in these situations. So when I talk about making crime impossible, the state is trying to make it so that the conduct cannot be committed. And I think it's important to recognize that the state doesn't do that in its typical response to crime. Punishment doesn't try to make it so crime never happens. In fact, the punitive state kind of accepts as a foundational assumption that crime is going to happen. The goal is to minimize it, is to try to make people act better, but it's not to make crime impossible. And so here we're talking about the goal of the state as opposed to really the effect, which is true impossibility is not itself possible.
So let's talk a little bit more about what we mean here. And again, you know, for the range of listeners on Hearsay Culture, there may be a good number of people familiar with this kind of technology. We used the dad's example, but before we even get into specifics, give us an idea of, generally speaking, the capabilities of technology today to make crime impossible as you have defined it.
Well, it ranges widely. I mean, it depends a lot on the type of crime. So, you know, a lot of core crimes that, you know, we think of, murder, theft, rape, things like that, obviously the technology does not exist to make those impossible at this point. I think the more realistic examples that we have at the moment are crimes that are really enabled by technology. So, you know, to the extent that a murder is somehow enabled by technology, we might be able to prevent it there. But really what we'd be more focused on are things like, you know, like I said earlier, drunk driving, which requires a car, a piece of technology to use, but also things like, viewing certain items on the internet to the extent that we wish to criminalize, for instance, the possession of child pornography. And that is being done over the internet. There's certainly the potential there to try to set up filtering systems that might prevent the activity that we wish to target. Likewise, referring to something you talked about in the opening, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, has some provisions in there that arguably seek to make it impossible for people to share copyrighted material in violation of that copyright.
So it was very interesting how you define impossibility. I think it's an important way to contextualize the discussion. If we're defining impossibility as the state's intent to make crime impossible, why is that distinction important versus defining impossibility as simply you individual cannot do what you want to do? So I guess my question boils down to, why is the state's intent your focus?
Well, the state's intent is my focus in large part because it matters in terms of how the technology is crafted. So the technology will be crafted in a way to try to act towards everyone equally, which I think has important consequences both kind of from a more theoretical standpoint in terms of whether we like the state treating everybody equally when it comes to preventing crime. But also, I think it has more practical consequences in that, the technology has to be more broad-based and in some ways stronger, more robust in order to prevent everyone from engaging in certain criminal activity. So I think you have a fair point in the sense that, you know, talking about the state's intent is a difficult thing to do. The state is not obviously a person and even trying to define legislative intent can be a real challenge. But it's, I think, nevertheless kind of important to see what the state is attempting to do as best we can for those kind of practical and theoretical reasons.
We're chatting with Mike Rich of Elon University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Mike, you alluded to it earlier, and you're absolutely right that I think a lot of people would say, yeah, the state's intent is to make crime impossible, and yeah, we have this drunk driving system, but anyone can get around it. I think it's useful since we don't have a tremendous amount of examples of technologies that currently exist to make crime impossible as you define it, to kind of get a little bit into the brass tacks of the primary example that you focus on in both of your articles, which is this drunk driving system. So perhaps, you know, from a technological perspective, recognizing that you're not a computer scientist and that this show isn't purely about technology. So, at a conversational level, describe a bit what the DADS system is and how it fits into your model, which we're going to talk about later, of thinking about this kind of technology.
Yeah, sure. The DADS technology, we're not 100% certain what it is. The DADS program is a joint program between the federal government and car makers to essentially try to create some technology that can identify the blood the alcohol level of the driver of a vehicle passively, accurately, and prevent the use of the car in the event that the BAL of the driver exceeds the legal limit. There are two main technologies that are being contemplated right now for DADS. One is a system that would passively measure the air in the passenger compartment of the vehicle and using, frankly, technology I don't understand, isolate what the driver's blood alcohol level is versus, obviously, those of any passengers or anything like that, and act accordingly. Alternatively, there is a system being discussed which would, when the driver attempts to start the vehicle, would shine light into the skin of the driver, so presumably the finger of the driver when the driver pushed the ignition button on the car. That would measure the blood alcohol level of the driver kind of from the way in which light is reflected and refracted through the skin and the blood of the driver. Either way, it would those are kind of the passive ways in which the technology would seek to measure the blood alcohol level of the driver. And it fits into my perfect prevention model in that, you know, obviously it's preventing crime before it happens, preventing that the individual from driving drunk before he or she is able to do so. And likewise would apply to everyone equally. I mean, one of the kind of stated goals of the program is implementation of this technology in all new vehicles. Now, there's been no stated intent by Congress or by the NTSB or Highway Traffic Safety Administration to require the use of this technology in all new vehicles. But nevertheless, it's not hard for us to imagine that's where we might go. I mean, if we have a viable technology that would prevent most of the instances of drunk driving, it's hard to imagine Congress kind of allowing that technology not to be used, or at least discussing its potential use.
So I asked this question earlier, but to get down to brass tacks. So, you know, the intention of the state is to prevent drunk driving, and so this technology exists that does things which, you know, even as you describe them, are pretty remarkable. How prevalent is this technology? In other words, if I go to a car dealer, can I choose to have this DADS system placed in the car? How does it wind up in my automobile?
Well, right now, no. Right now, they're working on prototypes of the technology, and I think we don't know exactly where the technology is. But my sense from the literature that's out there is that, you know, we're basically trying to get to a point where the technology is sufficiently accurate and also sufficiently reliable that it could be placed in cars. And what they've talked about now is a scenario much as you've described, which is either that individuals could want that technology placed in their car, or probably more likely the hope is that there would be a political groundswell in favor of the technology such that car manufacturers just start putting it in cars as a standard feature, and there's no need for kind of legal intervention to require it in all new cars.
So going one step further with this, and you know, this is not something you address in your article, but I'm curious because, and we're going to talk about it a bit later, how would you describe something like drone technology, right? The technology that is currently being deployed increasingly by law enforcement to identify criminals, perhaps to track them, right? I mean, it's not a possibility in the sense that you're preventing a crime from occurring, but you're using a technology that could be easily used to make it extremely difficult, right, for a criminal to act. Is something like the proverbial camera in the sky, as drones increasingly are, an example of what you would think of as perfect prevention, or is that something different?
I think as they're being used right now, it's something different in the sense that even no matter how prevalent, no matter how ubiquitous drones become as they currently stand, they're still about identifying individuals and kind of seeing crimes as they happen and making punishment more likely. And in that way, they want to prevent crime. They want we want people to know or at least fear that drones might be out there and that they might be being watched at any moment and thus they shouldn't commit crime. But that's still kind of working on the conscious agency of individuals. In other words, trying to get them to make the right choice. That being said, I think drones could very well be part of something that might start bleeding into perfect prevention, you know, to the extent that that we have advances in technology that make it easier for the state to be able to divine people's intent before they act. So to the, you know, extent that we can either, you know, divine their intent through, you know, some sort of neuroimaging or maybe even through the kind of predictive abilities, you know, kind of through prediction based on past actions of what individuals' intent are, and the drones could act to try to prevent crime in that way, we'd get something that starts to bleed maybe more into what we might think of as perfect prevention. You know, none of these kind of definitions are, I should say, none of these definitions are discrete, or at least none of these categories are discrete in the sense that things that look like punishment can eventually become preventive, can become perfectly preventive once they become, you know, more effective. It's just, but nevertheless, I think conceptually drones aren't to the point of perfect prevention yet, but they could be a tool of perfect prevention in the future.
And so last question in terms of contextualizing what this technology is. The DMCA, as you mentioned, and as I mentioned, is something that we talk about here on the show. As you alluded to, hackers have been able to get around technological protection measures fairly easily. The DMCA at this point, at least, you know, in my view, is used primarily, you know, from the notice and takedown perspective so that when a copyright holder, for example, is aware of what the copyright holder believes to be copyright infringement, that copyright holder can send a notice and the entity hosting the information or placing the information can respond accordingly. How is TPM, that is technological protection measures, right? The anti-copying technologies, which, like I said, have not been terribly effective. An example of impossibility, given the fact that it is in fact copyright holders as opposed to the state that are trying to in fact make that crime impossible.
Well, and here we need to recognize that there are different parts of the DMCA, right? So there are not only these, you know, notice and takedown provisions, but there's also what have been kind of termed the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA, which criminalize the creation of technology that allows for the avoidance of what you've termed TPMs, right? I mean, what we call TPMs. And so, the idea is not that the TPMs are perfect, but rather what the DMCA does is it makes it so that the technology is not created, at least not created and distributed on the widespread level that we would otherwise see to get around the TPMs. And, you know, I mean, here you kind of raise and get at another issue that I think it's important to recognize and a problem with perfect prevention, which is that because perfect prevention is, in fact, never going to be perfect, and there will always be people who can get around whatever technological kind of block you put on certain conduct, what you end up with is kind of a dual effect. I mean, on one hand, you have the impact of perfect preventive measures on the main population. Everybody as a general rule who isn't all that motivated can't engage in the criminal activity. And so, you know, I mean, yeah, you say that TPMs aren't effective, but at the same time, I think there's a good argument that they are. They're not effective against the highly motivated potential copyright violator, but they are very effective, I think, against those who might otherwise violate copyright without even really thinking about it. You know, so, you know, people who might otherwise, you know, share video games in a way that is in violation of copyright are not going to do it now because it's just hard. They don't want to go, you know, kind of go through the process of trying to find a place on the internet that might teach them how to violate or get around the TPMs that are in place to prevent that copying. And so what you have is you have, you know, most people who are being prevented from engaging in the activity, and then some very highly motivated criminals who are, one would think, probably even more dangerous to the extent that we think that there's some danger involved in the crime in the first place.
We're chatting with Professor Mike Rich, my colleague at Elon University on KZSU FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. All right, one or two more, you know, theoretical questions here, Mike, before we address the provocative question that you raise in your article: should we make crime impossible? But I want to push a little bit on this notion of intent as being the axis, because, you know, again, the the anti-circumvention provisions do, from a government perspective, create an intention, right, to not allow an unauthorized user to use a copyrighted work in a way that the, you know, either copyright owner wouldn't want or that the law doesn't allow by way of fair use. But isn't the technology itself so imperfect and the enforcement of it so focused on the private sector that what's happened with some of these technologies is that while it may be the state's intention to make crime impossible as you define it, in fact it's been co-opted by the private sector. And if that's the case, is there a problem with the technology itself in that it is not as susceptible to drawing bright lines between proper and improper use? And I grant that that's a long question, something we're going to get into after the break, but what's your initial reaction to that pushback?
Well, I mean, you raise an interesting question, and maybe this is what you're getting at, and maybe if it isn't. If it isn't, please let me know. But, you know, one thing I have been thinking about, and I don't have any real good answer to at the moment, is exactly how we ought to deal with the interface between public and private mm-hmm. when you're dealing with these sort of preventive technologies. Because,
yeah, and that is where I'm going.
Yeah, I mean, and we see it likewise with, you know, with the DADS technology. I mean, here you have technology that's being created not by the government, but really by the government in unison with car makers. And these private interests have their own interests in creating the technology as well. And I think the DMCA is even a stronger argument for the problem, because here you have copyright owners who have a really strong interest in regulating the use of their materials and maybe not drawing the bright lines that the law itself does draw. And to be perfectly honest, I don't know how to deal with that, because I think there are unique issues with government action in the criminal arena. I think government action is particularly offensive when it interferes with individual autonomy, and I think private action is less offensive, not necessarily inoffensive, but less offensive when it interferes with individual autonomy, especially to the extent that the individual can make a choice to avoid interfacing with that private entity if it wishes to. But I think the problem becomes when the government and the private entities join together, and I don't know exactly at which point public kind of the government's hand becomes so strong in working with private organizations that we've reached a point where now we should be talking about regulating that as if it's the government. But I think that's a very real question. And I think the DMCA, certainly the capture of that process by private entities is one that we should be concerned about.
And it's certainly, you know, that is among a few other reasons why, you know, I think this work is so interesting and challenging, because, my focus has been in a related area, what I believe to be the co-option of laws like trade secrecy for purely commercial interests, when in fact they're supposed to serve broader interests and where they don't encompass, public concerns like transparency and sharing information. This line drawing between public and private, I think, as you've said, is one that will just increasingly become both prominent and extremely challenging, particularly as governments and corporations work in tandem in a variety of areas, not just the traditional areas of investment, but increasingly, as you pointed out in your articles, in the areas of law enforcement. You're listening to KZSU-FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. As you know, those of you who listen to the show regularly know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope they continue to listen to Hearsay Culture and to the station. So, Mike, let's turn to this provocative title of your article that appears in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. Should we make crime impossible? So I'm going to throw you what might seem, you know, given the time and thought you put into this process, as a softball, but I think it's a really important question. The DADS technology, the example we keep talking about here, is one that prevents people from driving drunk and killing people on the road by virtue of the fact that that these individuals have been irresponsible and are driving a machine that's capable of killing people while they are intoxicated. Why not do that?
Well, when I started writing this article, my initial reaction was to be troubled by the idea of making crime impossible and thinking that I wasn't sold on the idea of DADS technology. And I'm still not 100% sold on it from a practical standpoint, from the sense of I'm not sure that we can create the technology and fine-tune it in the way that is sufficiently certain to not, you know, prevent people who are not drunk from driving and things like that. But let's assume for the moment that we could fine-tune the technology well enough to do that. I've kind of come around to the view that I think if there is a crime that the government should make impossible, it's probably a crime like drunk driving. And the reason for that, there's a few reasons for that, really. I mean, one is, you know, the enormous toll of drunk driving. I mean, in terms of, you know, deaths, we're talking still about, more than 10,000 deaths a year in car accidents that involve an intoxicated driver. Not to mention, you know, the thousands upon thousands of injuries, the billions of dollars in economic costs of drunk driving each year. It is a crime that is very harmful to society generally. The other, I think, important thing to recognize about drunk driving is that traditional methods of preventing it have pretty well proven to have failed to do so. And so to the extent, you know, we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years, an enormous investment by the government in trying to educate people about drunk driving and trying to essentially shame people into not driving drunk, to, you know, kind of teaching people that it is, you know, it is a socially irresponsible activity to engage in. And certainly those efforts have been effective to some extent, as have efforts to increase the penalties for drunk driving. I mean, nowadays, you know, once upon a time, drunk driving was a misdemeanor. Nowadays, driving drunk is often a felony, and certainly doing it repeatedly has very severe consequences for people. And those have been effective in some ways. We've seen a sharp drop in deaths and the frequency in which people drive drunk, but nevertheless, we still have this enormous social toll. And so there's a good argument to be made that, look, punishment doesn't work, traditional prevention does not appear to work, and the harm is so bad that if we can, in fact, prevent that harmful activity, we ought to do it. And I guess the other thing I ought to throw in there that's different about drunk driving from, say, a crime like murder is that drunk driving is not itself an intentional crime, in the sense that it is either intent to drive drunk is not required, but likewise, it's not a crime that is usually done intentionally. And in by which I mean, people don't go out in one night and say, I'm going to go to the bar with the goal of getting drunk and then driving. Instead, rather, driving drunk is a risky activity that people engage in for kind of because they've gotten themselves in the position to do so. And so, in my view at least, there's not the same moral issues that arise with interfering with people's kind of moral choices that we might have if we're talking about preventing murder or theft or something like that. But that's an issue we can also get into. But anyway, so drunk driving, in my view, is kind of a unique crime in that way. It has all of these factors all mushed together and seems, therefore, if we're ever going to prevent a crime, drunk driving ought to be that crime.
And so you mentioned in your articles that this technology, as you've pointed out, is the low-hanging fruit from a scholarly perspective, because it's relatively easy to lay out the arguments. Because, quite frankly, if you ask, should we make drunk driving impossible as opposed to should we make crime impossible, I think most people, and I would be among them, would say yes, we should pretty much do that. And in large measure, you seem to be reaching that conclusion. But what is an example of the, very poorly play off the low-hanging fruit and really in a remarkably uncreative way, what is an example of the high-hanging fruit where we might one day, or, and I don't mean one day in the science fiction sense, but to the extent you're aware of it, one day may have the technology to make that kind of crime impossible. Can you give us an example of that?
You know, I mean, I think now, well, I mean, okay, let's, you know, let's take an example that I think is pretty realistic, which is, let's say we could make it impossible to access child pornography on the internet. I mean, here we can look to other countries that have, you know, attempted to use technology to do just that. So go to Great Britain and, you'll find the Internet Watch Foundation, which, you know, is a semi-private organization, which has some, you know, kind of government, stamp of approval. But nevertheless, it's a private organization that, you know, creates a blacklist of websites that, they believe contain child pornography, and other offensive, as specifically defined by the government there, materials, and distributes that blacklist to internet service providers, which are then strongly pressured by the government to, block access by their subscribers to those websites. Now, you know, that sort of technology could easily be imported here. I mean, and setting aside First Amendment concerns, which certainly exist, and I don't mean to minimize, but aren't kind of my issue at the moment. But, you know, taking those aside, I mean, the question becomes, if we could, without otherwise violating the Constitution, you know, make it impossible to access child pornography on the internet, should we do so? And, you know, I think then you end up with what I see as being a harder question. And I think for all three of the reasons why drunk driving might be appropriate, it is not as entirely clear that preventing access to child pornography should be made impossible. I mean, first you have probably the most debatable question, which is, what is the social harm of the viewing of child pornography? And there are lots of kind of arguments to be made, and I am not trying to kind of address the validity of those, about kind of the ancillary harms of, you know, creating a market for child pornography by allowing it to be viewed, the harms to the individual in that, in the pornography, that, you know, of knowing that those images continue to be distributed. I mean, those are real harms, but of course, in comparison to the harm of drunk driving, are they as, you know, kind of substantial that we want to necessarily prevent that crime entirely, particularly in light of the fact that it's not as clear that, that traditional methods have been, you know, wholly ineffective in kind of rooting out the crime. I mean, we don't have as much data as we do with respect to drunk driving about how much viewing of child pornography is really going on now compared to 30 years ago before we really started ramping up the punishment for possession of child pornography. And then there's the issue of intent, which I referenced with drunk driving, and I think is maybe the core, really this core moral issue that I think we need to wrestle with, which is it the role of the state to step in and prevent people from making bad choices? You know, it's the role of the state maybe to prevent them from engaging in risky activity like drunk driving that they don't really mean to do anyway, that's, again, ancillary to other intentional bad choices that they're making. But here you have somebody choosing to view child pornography. Should the state be stepping in there and preventing them from being able to do that? It is morally wrong, but isn't kind of a core part of our, you know, human agency, our ability to make these wrong moral choices and frankly act on them and then be punished for them? You know, there's a long history of philosophical thought that says that no. I mean, part of human agency is being able to is doing the wrong thing and then being punished for it. And so I think that's just a question that we as a society need to wrestle with when we deal with an issue like preventing the viewing of child pornography, because there's absolutely no question that that's something that gets people really riled up from a political standpoint, and there's a real strong political pressure to prevent.
We're chatting with Mike Rich of Elon Law, author of two articles regarding perfect prevention of crime on KJCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, it's interesting, Mike, you know, and by the way, I should note now we're getting near what I call the unfair portion of the show, which is when I start asking you questions that you can't answer adequately in the time that we have left, and that's the fun part for me, and the not as fun part for my guests.
So this is the speed round, in other words.
The speed round, exactly. Okay. Exactly. I mean, you're welcome to use the time that you have. It's just that even then, I could tweet the question to really make your answer impossible, as opposed to crime. But you know, you mentioned something earlier, which I think is interesting, and I want to dive into a little bit before we, you know, close. You talked about drunk driving as a situation where the intent of the driver, you know, is not to go and drive drunk, but it merely, and I'm going to use, you know, the word externality, or an ancillary, effect of the drinking is that you have to drive to get somewhere and therefore you get in the car and you're driving drunk. When we're talking about the viewing of child pornography, you're not making with this technology the creation of child pornography impossible. In other words, these, you know, and I will obviously, and I think virtually everyone would say these morally reprehensible individuals that victimize children, you know, by sexually assaulting them, and then filming it are not prevented by the technology that you're describing from actually committing that crime. Rather, it's the related crime of viewing this material that is criminalized. Again, is that a distinction of note? In other words, you know, whereas with drunk driving, your technology might have the ability to literally create a situation where one cannot harm another by virtue of driving drunk and therefore really prevent a crime. Versus, again, and maybe I'm making a moral judgment here too, because of course the viewing of child pornography is also morally reprehensible, but the actual victimization is what ultimately we want to prevent in order to prevent, quote unquote, this crime from happening. That's a distinction. Is it a distinction worth noting in your view of how we think about the technology?
Well, I mean, I don't know that the distinction between, you know, ancillary, if there's a helpful distinction between, you know, ancillary and kind of core crimes. I mean, I absolutely, right? I mean, the actual victimization of children is worse than the viewing of child pornography. I think most people would agree if we tried to rank, you know, the moral wrongfulness of certain activities. You know, that being said, I think there is a difference between the child pornography example and the drunk driving example in that we as a society have decided that the viewing of child pornography, though ancillary to a core, you know, even greater harm, is itself a separate independent harm. So it's we don't punish the viewing of child pornography only because it creates a market for the initial victimization of children. We view it as a kind of separate and an additional harm to the child victim as well. And that's why we punish it. And so, and I think even more importantly, and now we kind of get into maybe a little more of a brass tacks issue, is that it is clear that we view it as a harm. And the way we know that is because accidentally viewing child pornography is not a crime. There is a mens rea element. There is a mental state that must be present before the individual is going to be punished. And what exactly that mental state is can vary from state to state, but as a general matter, you know, you will need to have meant to have seen child pornography and possess it in order to be punished for that. And that's because that crime is in some ways different. I mean, you know, as opposed to drunk driving, which is essentially a strict liability crime in every state, in that if you get behind the wheel of a car with a blood alcohol level in excess of 0.08, you're going to be guilty of a crime, regardless of whether you knew your blood alcohol level was in excess of that limit, whether you wanted to drive drunk or anything like that. So in that way, I think the two crimes are different there. Intent is part of the viewing of child pornography in the way that it is not with drunk driving. And then the other thing is too, the core activity that drunk driving is ancillary to, going out and drinking and getting drunk, is not itself a crime in the way that the victimization of children is.
So it's extremely challenging area, which is why again these questions become increasingly unfair. But let's push a little further on this issue. You know, from a practical perspective, the technology exists, and I think one of the, you know, the real practical issues that we want to think about here, frankly, is this question of should we make crime impossible if we can do X, Y, and Z. And I think I'm hearing you say that your general answer might be, yes, we should make crime impossible if we meet certain standards, as opposed to generally saying, well, if you can make it impossible, let's do it. One of the scholars that you cite in your articles whose work I hold in exceptionally high regard is Professor Daniel Citron at the University of Maryland, who wrote a terrific article a few years ago called Technological Due Process, one that's influenced my work as it's influenced yours. You explain Professor Citron's work by saying that automated decision-making, and I'm quoting from your article, about protected interest raises due process issues because of the difficulty of providing adequate notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard to affected individuals. So, you know, in the remaining, you know, few minutes that we have, and I have one or two closing questions, let's talk a little about that. I mean, as far as due process goes, do we have the ability today, even given the nascent existence of this technology, to meet the due process? And by that, I literally mean notice. That is, you individual are aware that an allegation is being made against you, an opportunity to be heard, which I'll simply define as the ability to defend yourself. Do we have the ability technologically to do that today?
You know, I think the answer to that question boils down to whether we mean to give people meaningful due process. I mean, because at the end of the day, the answer is, I think, clearly no. If you're talking about I don't mean to, you know, beat a dead horse, but it is the best example we have of a potential technology that we might have to face the question whether we want to implement, is this DADS technology. You know, and there you have what is viewed as a protected interest, your kind of, it's not a right, it's a privilege, but nevertheless, once the state grants it to you, they can't take it away without due process, which is the ability to drive. And, you know, I think the argument in favor of DADS technology from the due process standpoint would be one of implicit consent, is that, you know, look, if you choose to get behind the wheel knowing that there is this DADS technology in place in your vehicle, you are impliedly consenting to the fact that if it decides your blood alcohol level is in excess of a certain legal limit, you're going to lose your ability to drive for X period of time, you know, until your blood alcohol level, you know, lowers, or until, you know, possibly the system resets so that if there's an error, that error can be resolved. I don't find that enormously satisfying because, in fact, that consent is no consent at all. You know, to the extent that we're going to require, either, you know, with a actual legislative fiat or essentially, you know, through, political will, you know, that, or the, you know, perceived political will, DADS technology appears in all vehicles. It's not really implied consent, because you're not consenting to anything. You're driving, and you have to subject yourself to this sort of technology, and you have no choice in the matter. So I don't really buy that. I think the other argument would be, to the extent that individuals have some input into the decision whether to require the DADS technology, maybe that's sufficient. And so if you lose the political battle, then your due process rights are, you know, ultimately satisfied. And frankly, I'm not enough of a constitutional scholar to say from the constitutional standpoint if that's sufficient. But personally, I'm not sure that I'm 100% comfortable with that answer either, because I think, you know, what we've seen, through a number of years with the political economy of criminal law is that the political pressures to punish and prevent crime are so strong that it's hard to say that it's even maybe a fair political process when a technology like this were to appear. The forces in favor of implementation of the technology are going to be so strong as opposed to those who might oppose it.
So, Mike, in our closing few minutes, and you mentioned a political process, which is key. You know, in the time since you've drafted these articles, I recognize that the Connecticut piece is still forthcoming, but you didn't address this in the article, but I think we should talk about it. So, you know, the last few months, of course, has, as a result of the, you know, leaks from Edward Snowden and perhaps others, has revealed an extensive wiretapping for lack of a better phrase, really data sniffing operation, authorized, at least arguably authorized, by federal law, that has allowed for the, increasingly, each day it seems we get more information, the ability of law enforcement and others inside government to literally track, you know, every communication made by an individual using the internet. Of course, as we're recording the show, and we're recording the show on August 8th, we are apparently under threat from Al-Qaeda, from data that has been adduced through intelligence sources and perhaps through the same systems that are now being challenged by civil libertarians and others, of an Al-Qaeda attack that has resulted in the closing of numerous U.S. embassies overseas. There's, again, I think an example of two things you pointed to, and I want to get your reaction to it. A, is literally this data sniffing another example of making crime impossible or perfect prevention as you define it, but perhaps more importantly, the political process. I mean, the NSA program that at least the government is suggesting is responsible for finding out about these proposed attacks also came within a couple of votes a short while ago from being undone basically by Congress. What are the political wins on this kind of issue right now today? Because I suspect that when you drafted these articles, you might have said something different about the politics. So, again, I said this is an unfair portion of the show because you have about 3 minutes to answer these questions.
All right, great. So, real quick on the perfect prevention side. I mean, again, much as the drone technology could theoretically be part of perfect prevention, so too could this sort of data sniffing. I mean, to the extent that the data is being used to, divine criminal conduct before it occurs and really, interfere with anyone's ability to do certain activity based on that divining, it could theoretically be part of perfect prevention. But I think that's a less interesting question than the political one that you've raised. And I mean, for me as somebody, I like to think of myself as a civil libertarian, I find it very, comforting that, maybe we have finally reached a point at which people generally are upset by the extent of the government's reach when it comes to criminal conduct. Now, and in some ways this is particularly surprising because, I mean, we're not just talking about criminal conduct. We're talking about, even the greater boogeyman of terrorism where, there has been a time for the last 13 years where you say terrorism and that can be used to justify pretty much anything that the government wants to do. And maybe we have finally seen the limits of the public's willingness to allow the government free rein to prevent whatever it calls terrorism. That being said, we haven't stopped the program yet. Hopefully we will put some limits on it and we will, reach a point where even if we don't stop the program, we implement some amount of transparency in how it works. But I do think the political winds are maybe shifting a little bit, though I wonder when we get to an area that is frankly, maybe less amorphous than terrorism to take it again back to drunk driving, where everybody kind of can have, at a real visceral level, connect to the harms of that crime, whether or not the political winds will still be blowing in the same direction.
Mike Rich, my colleague at Elon Law, thank you for joining us in Hearsay Culture. I really wanted to do it, but I try to make the show as friendly as possible. I really, if this were, Bill O'Reilly or Rachel Maddow or something like that, I would say, okay, Rich, now I need an answer. Should we make crime impossible, yes or no? But this isn't that kind of show, and I think it's a more contextual problem. So I'm going to skip that question. Mike Rich, author of two articles that you can find both on the Social Science Research Network, SSRN, and also, at least in the case of the Harvard Journal, on the Harvard Journal Law and Public Policy's website. Two articles, Should We Make Crime Impossible, published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and Limits on the Perfect Preventative State. State, forthcoming in the University of Connecticut Law Review. Mike, thank you for joining us today on the show. This is a great topic. I invite you back to continue the discussion, but thank you for joining us today and enlightening my listeners on this burgeoning technology.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I look forward to any thoughts that your listeners might have. Please.
I was going to ask you, so to the extent that people want to offer you feedback, do you want to offer a way to reach you?
Yeah, please. I think the best way would be by email at mrich2@elon.edu.
Thank you, Mike. For those of you who are paying attention, you'll see that we're about halfway through the summer quarter on KZSU's schedule. Upcoming guests include Professor Tim Jordan of King's College London on hacking, Jason Cross of Duke Law, Ellen Broad of the Australian Digital Alliance, Professor Phil Napoli of Fordham University on algorithms and media, and Professor Anupam Chander of University of Davis, University of California Davis Law on international trade and its impact on the IP industries. As always, you have several ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen this quarter live on KZSU Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific time by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also listen to the show via podcast by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to the iTunes page for CIS. Lastly, you can get all previous shows, the upcoming schedule, and other information about the show by going to hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining us today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.